have young sister fair beyond and say, Peri Meridictum Domine, mani be the druries that she sent to me. Partum quartum paradisentem, Peri Meridictum Domine. She sent to me the cherry without any stone, Peri Meridictum Domine. And so she did the dove without any bone. Partum quartum paradisentem, Peri Meridictum Domine. She sent me the brera without any rind, Peri Meridictum Domine. She bade me love me layman without longing, partum quartum paradisentem, Peri Meridictum Domine. How should any cherry be without a stone, Peri Meridictum Domine? How should any dove be without a bone? Partum quartum paradisentem, Peri Meridictum Domine. How should any bread be without a ring? Peri Meridictum Domine. How should he love me layman without longing? Partum quartum paradisentem, Peri Meridictum Domine. When the cherry was a flower and had it known stored, Peri Meridictum Domine. When the dove was an eath and had it known born, partum quartum paradisentem, Peri Meridictum Domine. Then had its known ring, Peri Meridictum Domine. When the maid has that she loveth, she's without longing, partum quartum paradisentem, Peri Meridictum Domine. He have a young sister fair beyond and say, Peri Meridictum Domine, mani be the druries that she sent to me. Partum quartum paradisentem, Peri Meridictum Domine.
Hello. It's good to talk with you. Felix Cohen was born in New York City in 1907. He went to the famous Forcing House High School for the highly gifted Townsend Harris. He attended the City College of New York. He earned a master's and a PhD in philosophy at Harvard and graduated from Columbia Law School in 1931 at the age of 24. He went to work for the United States government in 1933 after the election of Franklin Roosevelt in the first influx of the young people, men, but not only men, known as Felix's Boys, not after him but after Felix Frankfurter, who came to work as the first crop of people in the American administrative state, as we have known it since the New Deal, also the first time that Jewish people could be allowed to work in American government, pretty much. In the circle of the distribution of talented young lawyers through the federal government, for which Felix Frankfurter was largely responsible, Cohen landed at the Interior Department, where he participated in the drafting of another one of the monumental New Deal statutes. We're familiar with the securities laws and the labor laws of the United States, also produced in the course of the few first years of the Roosevelt administration, largely by Felix's boys, and therefore largely by Jewish lawyers. But Cohen's work was unique. At the beginning of the New Deal, the Roosevelt administration decided that it wanted to deal with the problems of poverty in the United States by actually addressing the problems of people who were poor, among whom were the indigenous native population of the United States. And for the first time in U.S. history, a theory of the well-being of the native population began to be heard in government, and the theory in which the Roosevelt administration then believed was that strong tribal governments would produce welfare for their people and turn the well-being of the native population back into the care of the leadership of the tribes. Hence the idea of the so-called Indian New Deal, the Reconstruction Act of which, rebuilding or at least attempting to rebuild strong tribal governments as a source of well-being to native people, was embodied in the Native Reconstruction Act, in the Indian Reconstruction Act, of which Cohen was a leading author. He then became, for 14 years, the person most responsible for the understanding of the law of Native people in the United States government and the active participant with the Justice and Interior Departments in the first great survey of American so-called Indian law. Like many intellectual and practical households in the professional classes of the United States in the 20th century, Felix Cohen was actually the lead partner in a two-person collective partnership for the doing of thinking and practical business in this world. Smart women married smart men who received the salaries and got the credit, but the partnership was, of course, real if unacknowledged. Lucy Kramer Cohen was born also in 1907 and earned a bachelor's degree in anthropology and mathematics at Barnard College and a master's in mathematics at Columbia University across the street. She was, as a statistician and an anthropologist, a research associate of the great Franz Boas, who made American anthropology at Columbia, a extraordinary tradition now essentially deceased, and was with Felix Cohen, the other partner in their collective understanding of American Indian law. The first handbook of American Indian law, published only by the History Department, by the Interior Department, after the Justice Department fired Felix Cohen from its collaboration in the production of the handbook of American Indian law, either as he believed for reasons of anti-Semitism or for reasons of dangerousness, because the handbook promised to be a system of for helping tribes become legally more potent, is a historical question. But the handbook itself is a masterpiece not only of legal collection, but of ethnography and interpretive anthropology, and bears as much the stamp of Lucy Kramer Cohen as any book that has the author's name on it would do. The Handbook of American Indian Law, published first in 1941, became one of the most important attempts by non-Native people in North America ever to understand the Native people of North America. It has been reissued in its original form once since, and it gave birth to a second and third federal handbook of American Indian Law in the later 20th century. Long after Felix Cohen was dead. Cohen resigned from the United States government in 1947 because the American official government changed, as it has often done, 180 degrees, its view of how Native people ought to be treated. And after 1947, we went through a second, a lengthy period in which the policy of the United States government was to destroy tribal government and return the Native population of the United States to the condition of wardship of the federal government, in which after the genocide period largely concluded, American official government has believed that Native people should live. Cohen then went to Yale to teach philosophy of law in the footsteps of his father, Morris Raphael Cohen, who was the most distinguished legal philosopher in the first half of the United States of the 20th century in the United States. He published a collection of papers on legal philosophy with his father, and won a large number of litigations against the federal government in Indian matters, including actions securing the rights of Native people to vote in the states of Mexico and Arizona in elections like other American people, and a number of land claims cases. He died at the age of 46 in 1953. Lucy Kramer Cohen lived almost 60 years longer than her husband. She died at the age of 100 in 2007, and I had the privilege of a couple of occasions on which to talk with her about, the history they made together, about which everybody pretty much forgot her part. She did publish also a collection of her husband's essays 10 years after his death. I don't usually engage in long biographical discussion of the authors that we read, but it will help, I think, to understand why, from my point of view, we are here walking through law school in footsteps made by a pair of giants, let us say, to whom much is owed that cannot be repaid, but at least we can understand from Felix and Lucy Cohen that it can be done. What is it that can be done? That is to say, what is it that we are actually learning here? As I have said, our effort to figure out how to be creative in law school and to think about a lawyer's life is a process that begins with an understanding of what is distinctive about American law thought, namely American legal realism, of which there is, I think, no greater masterwork than the two simple essays that we now have read together, The Path of the Law and Transcendental Nonsense and The Functional Approach. Both of them essays by philosophically minded lawyers whose effort it is to write simply and to convey fundamental understandings about law, legal process, and being a lawyer, which are, like any billboard, compressed and evocative more than they are exhaustively explanatory, And which, like billboards, can be frustrating if you want to look at the landscape behind them. But they are most definitely great billboards addressed to you. The two primary ideas of American legal realism are, first, we have already observed, that legal things, like other things, are what they do, not what they are called, and that their relationship is a relationship which runs through the reality that they both express and alter, and not through some logical relationship between the ideas apart from the society in which they are embedded. The second great idea, fundamental principle of American legal realism, is the one expressed nowhere more succinctly than it is expressed by Cohen here. That is that although judges and lawyers need not be legal scientists, it is of some practical importance that they should recognize that your traditional language of argument and opinion neither explains nor justifies court decisions. When the vivid fictions and metaphors of traditional jurisprudence are thought of as reasons for decisions, rather than poetical or mnemonic devices for formulating decisions reached on other grounds, then the author, as well as the reader of the opinion or argument, is apt to forget the social forces which mold the law and the social ideals by which the law is to be judged. To put it still more simply, judicial opinions are rationalizations, both in the psychological and in the logical sense. They are post hoc. They are an attempt to apply the image of rationality to decisions arrived at by other means and reached on other grounds. This is the point of Holmes' set of phrases, of which I have taken the one from the common law rather than the path of the law as the simpler, that the life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience. It is the felt necessities of the times and the prejudices of the judges more than logic, more than the functional discussion of the relationship between concepts where function is defined in logical terms by implication, inference, and deduction, not in the terms, as Cohen points out, in which we really ought to think about function, that is, in the functionalist anthropology of Franz Boas. Everywhere in this world of the thought of Felix Cohen, we are also in the presence of the thought of Lucy Kramer Cohen, who is simply not getting credit. But that structure joins to the one which brings us into the presence for the first time in this experience of ours, hardly for the last, with the other of the three great ideas of the 19th century, the one we call Freud. The 19th century gave to us as its endowment, here I suppose I must mean by us, those of us who started our lives in the middle of the 20th century and are now old, the 19th century gave to us three great ideas, one that we call Darwin, one that we call Marx, and one that we call Freud. The scope of the importance of the idea that we call Darwin is beyond measure and affects every single way in which we think not merely about the natural world and ourselves, but about the business of thinking. The idea that we call Marx, well, of course, we're not allowed to know it here. The mere effort to understand the greatest of all the theories of historical materialism, of which there are many, immediately results in a bunch of shouting over socialism, and therefore we will leave it for another day. But the idea that we call Freud, which begins in the root idea that the bulk of all human mental activity is unconscious, is apparently the most difficult of all to accept. And the 20th century spent most of its time trying to reject it, even as it reveled in it, used it, capitalized it, and in every respect demonstrated the fullness of its importance and its truth. And in that sense, rationalization means not merely the post hoc imposition of our forms of formal thinking on the world. The condition of our thinking about the universe at all is that it can be thought about logically, but also the process by which human beings simultaneously deny and surrender to the action of the unconscious by false mythological efforts to render their unconscious thinking as argument. The problem that the law is made of this was the great problem of the single most controversial work of legal scholarship that American legal realism has ever produced, Jerome Frank's Law and the Modern Mind, which was an explicit attempt to apply the idea we call Freud to the law, and more importantly to the lawyers, which resulted, as I say, in the greatest of all controversies and the most fully expressed form of loathing you can have without Twitter, all of which was directed at Jerome Frank for the publication of that work. We will sidle around Law and the Modern Mind, I think, this term, rather than going directly at it. You have more than enough unconscious activity of your own to deal with at the moment. But that idea that the judicial opinion is rationalization, both in the sense of the ad hoc, post hoc imposition of logic on the phenomena of social decision making, and also in the sense of the active attempt to dissociate away all unconscious understandings of the law by rendering everything in terms of argument, a form of behavior which you have already learned, and which in true excellent law student behavior, and I do mean excellent, you were chosen to be very good at it, and you now apply by quibbling over everything, turning everything into an argument, trying to find a verbal or logical trick that can be used to reject ideas as they are offered to you, a phenomenon which in which you underestimate the extent to which you have been conditioned, and you overestimate the extent to which you're merely responding to having way too much reading, a subject to which I'll return later today. But let's then say that the two great ideas of legal realism, that things are what they do, not what they're called, and that judicial opinions and other forms of lawmaking are rationalizations of decisions reached on other grounds and arrived at by other means, constitute the invitation that we are accepting in this course. Felix Cohen says that acts of law and acts of social technology and change, like equipping police cars with radios, are social forces. Imagine what it means to have said in 1935 that equipping police cars with radios is a prime example of a social force. In the world of 2020, we had no difficulty understanding what that means. America is still trying hard to come to grips with how what it can possibly mean. Is a police officer kneeling on the neck of a man until he's dead, or shooting a woman asleep in her bed multiple times. America can understand, or is claiming that it can understand, what some Americans have always known. That one of the things that it means is that we can detect the blackness of the person getting dead without much trouble. But it needs to understand what it means to say that the technology of policing is a social force, like a law, and it can't quite do that because it can't understand what the words defund the police mean. And if what it said was take away the radios, that wouldn't be very, you know, that would be ill-received and misunderstood too. We will have more to say about technology and policing as we go through this course. It's not merely a valid, but at the moment an urgent subject. But let us, for the moment, only point out that for a man who understands that equipping police cars with radios is a social force, and who was, for his committed and deeply too short life, the servant of a transient idea in the federal government that the people who governed themselves before we got here to declare the importance of self-government should be able to govern themselves, and that this form of self-government is a potent social force, is a person both deeply understanding the nature of law and also deeply understanding how to be a lawyer. To master the nature of the social forces which create, support, and are rationalized by decisions and other lawmaking. It's just as clear as it could be. Unfortunately, as clear as it could be is not enough to tell you how to be creative in law school or how to live a fulfilled lawyer's life, but it's getting there. We can see what this has to do with transcendental nonsense easily enough. Transcendental nonsense is the language of rationalization in two senses, the two senses we have already described. Transcendental nonsense is the language of rationalization in that it allows legal phenomena to be described, decisions that actually occur in society, to be described as though they occurred in law. That is to say, the vocabulary which voices them is vocabulary of law thought only. The relationships among the nouns distinguished by the verbs are relationships among legal entities independent of social correlatives. They just don't have to pay for themselves in the language of actual social phenomena because they pay for themselves in the language of the law. If where a corporation may be sued is where the corporation, quote, is, close quote, then to speak the language of that extremely talented lawyer and even more talented liar, William Jefferson Clinton, it all depends upon what the meaning of the word is. Is the corporation in New York? Now, you see, because you had civil procedure in the early 21st century, that around the time Felix Cohen was leaving federal government, the United States Supreme Court said that all that where is the corporation is stuff depends upon whether under the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, taking everything into account, it would be on the whole just to allow the corporation to be sued there, which is, after all, exactly what Felix Cohen said in 1935 in Transcendental Nonsense, and which was in the famous shoe machinery case that all of you remember, fundamentally decided by the United States Supreme Court just a few years later to be the way the word is in the language of where is a corporation suable. Here, in the end, it turned out that, like the end of Transcendental Nonsense and the functional approach, the guide to the whole thing is not much more satisfactory than Sunday school ethics, where, on the whole, would it be not unjust to allow the corporation to be sued is just an ethical principle without even much content to be offered to it. And whether that is a great deal more or less satisfactory than the New York CPLR's determination that a corporation is suable in New York if it is doing business in New York, where what it turns out to mean to say that it is doing business, though there are a lot more words attached to it, comes down to whether, in all fairness and justice, it would be okay to sue them here. But Cohen's point, that whatever one says about that, unless one says what ultimately, in the great magical shoe case, it turned out to be necessary to say, which is, yeah, well, you can sue people if it is not manifestly beyond fairness and justice to put them to the work of hiring lawyers and appearing in court in a particular place. Anything short of that is an effort to apply logic, where what we really want to know is the social result. Are plaintiffs going to be able to reach here the businesses they believe have injured them here, wherever here might be? And at least from my point of view, more importantly, how we dissociate away the fact that in the end, all such apparently straightforward decisions of civil procedure are actually decisions of social value being adjudicated by, and here, how could it possibly matter whether they are elected judges of the New York Court of Appeals or unelected judges of the SDNY or the Second Circuit or the United States Supreme Court? As though the presence of a judicial election scheme could make it more or less appropriate for judges ultimately to have to make a decision which is ultimately a matter of social ethics. Is it, in all fairness and justice, appropriate for this lawsuit against this corporation, which is officially, in some other sense, an entity of state Y or country Z, to sue them here, to make them accountable here, to the judicial process here, wherever here might be, at the instance of a plaintiff who finds it to be convenient in whatever sense to bring the problem before these judges in this place? And as Cohen says, you can multiply indefinitely examples, both examples from the law of the United States before 1935 and for all that we ultimately came to adopt the Holmes and Cohen view of what the law is, in the law of now, no difficulty whatever you will find in multiplying the illustrations of the ways in which legal language is chosen to refer only to itself and not to social reality lying behind it. This is part of the many forms of annoyance that you find yourselves having with the cases as it is explained to you what the PV houses should or shouldn't get when the coal miners dig up their land, or what it is that should or shouldn't happen when the palm of one's hand grows hair, or any of the other elements, but it is because of people like Felix Cohen and Kessler and Gilmore that your contracts book begins not with the offer and the acceptance, but with the damages. That is, what does all this contract law actually mean when it hits the ground and somebody either does or doesn't have to export vaccines manufactured in the United Kingdom across the channel to the now third country that is the EU? After all, that's really a question of contract law, and what really matters at the end of the day isn't the contract law, it's the vaccine. As if students at Columbia University declared that they wish to breach their agreement to pay their tuition in return for the education they receive, and the question isn't really the contract law. The question is really how to distribute the pain, uncertainty, and doubt arising from social collapse in an epidemic for which both the public health systems and the teachers and administrators and students in universities were unprepared. Again, I think this is a matter of extreme importance, and we'll talk about it again later in this moment of ours, but let's, for the moment, stick to where we are. Law rationalizes both in the sense of giving rationale to and of dissociating away the unconscious and social elements of the decisions which actually rule people's lives, because they both represent and amplify social forces like criminal restraint and punishment, like financial markets organization, like whether the gas tank of your vehicle is not going to explode, or whether the battery in your vehicle without a gas tank is going to poison you or the environment, and what is actually happening to the atmosphere of Earth. From Cohen's point of view, well, I think now it is required to say from the two Cohen's points of view, we also need to take into account the impulse that we have once we understand these ideas that we call Darwin and Freud. Once we find ourselves on their side, rather than attempting to bat them away and to make America great again, we will find ourselves with another unconsciously generated impulse to functionalize. That is, to improve the quality of our analysis by broadening its outlook, while continuing to assume that social phenomena can in the end be understood comprehensively, not merely partially, by seeing what they do. Functionalism in anthropology is also a form of storytelling. The work of Jim Clifford, among others, was devoted at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st to demonstrating the way in which anthropology is its own fantasy, and the functionalism with which American anthropology starts, in particular in Boas, is more sophisticated then and less racist and ethnocentrist then, but just as incomplete as any previous attempt by one set of human beings to observe another one through the long end of the telescope and to discover what these natives think, or even what it means. Functionalizing, from Cohen's point of view, depends upon a stream of understanding rising up from the fundamentals of the philosophy of mathematics to our understanding of non-determinate social phenomena, like the ones in which Cohen is particularly interested that we call law. And it's a great irony of the history of thought that the publication of Transcendental Nonsense on the Functional Approach in 1935 occurred within months of the publication of Kurt Gödel's enormously important paper on the undecidability of formal systems, one of the greatest works in the history of mathematics, indeed designed to prove that the functionalism of Russell and Whitehead and their understanding of the philosophy of arithmetic was wrong. Not just wrong in some trivial sense, but wrong in the sense that, as Gödel's proof demonstrated, no system of formal reasoning can prove only true theorems without either failing to prove some theorems that are true or proving some to be true that are false. This immensely beautiful, elegant proof of the inadequacy of formal logic and the inability to achieve the closure that Russell and Whitehead had claimed to achieve with respect to how arithmetic works is at one and the same time a refutation and a demonstration of Felix Cohen's point about the nature of legal reasoning. A disproof in the sense that no functionalism can escape the difficulty that its explanations will either prove the false or fail to prove the true, in whatever sense false, true, and prove might take on in the discipline in which they are directed, and at the same time requires, therefore, that anything less pure than the theory of arithmetic, like, for example, the decision about what will happen if the minimum wage goes to $15 an hour and whether it ought, therefore, to go to $15 an hour, will require us to recognize that the idea of proof in logic, or for that matter, mathematized economic theory, which is the primary form in which social policy reasoning has been carried out for the last more than half a century, almost 75 years, that such reasoning is inevitably incomplete and can never be more than a narrative structure that we use to explain why we feel that we need to do what the law seems to be compelling us to do. No doubt that means that the thing we would like to understand, as Cohen points out, is how are decisions actually made? How do courts decide cases of a given kind? How do regulatory agencies actually make their rules? How does Congress... Oh, well, let us not even ask that question. And then, how should courts decide cases of any given kind? How should regulatory agencies make the decisions which ultimately affect the operation of all the businesses and all the educational institutions in society? How should Congress? Now we are getting somewhere. It's simply that, like H.L. Mencken, we are likely to conclude that whatever Congress should do is pretty much the opposite of what it will do. But that won't change the fact that, at least if we think in terms of Felix Cohen's Sunday school ethics, Felix Solomon Cohen and Lucy Kramer Cohen, writing about how our decisions in society are really and ought to be acknowledgedly based upon our Sunday school ethics, I ask you, but of course, that's the weakest part of the article. All of you were quick to see how easy it is to quibble with that, how underbaked and undefined this grasp of ethics is. Because, of course, the idea is to write another piece about that. But this is the masterpiece, despite the flaw in its golden bowl. How cases ought to be decided, about which you are, of course, very clear in your mind. You know all sorts of things about how cases ought to be decided. You've begun figuring out, and you will continue figuring out for a lifetime, all the cases that you think are wrongly decided, just as you will know very clearly how law school is wrongly being managed during the epidemic. Knowing how cases ought to be decided is easy if having an opinion about ought is no more difficult than having an opinion about logic, but it is. And the intermediate term, that first we have to really understand what's going on, we have to get all the meaningless concepts out and replace them with actual understanding about how society functions and what the consequences are of our interventions in it. Whether we are the men of economics and statistics, actually, that would be Lucy Kramer Cohen, the woman of statistics and anthropology, or we are the man of the house who is the philosopher, but also who is the theorist of social forces. When we put those two together, when we, let us say, marry them together, though we would hope that in the marriage everybody will keep her and his and its and their own names and get all here and there and its and his credit, When we actually put that all together, it isn't simple. Indeed, it isn't unitary. It's a box of different things we need to understand. And so now, I know it's late, it's already almost week 3, and by God, we do have only 12, but trust me, we can get there from here without having to have a heart attack running uphill. Here, now, almost in week 3, we are almost ready to begin thinking about having a lawyer's theory of social action. That would be a theory which would explain to us one way or another, to one extent or another, incompletely and interpretively, rather than logically and with complete verbal precision. Hold your quibbling. That would be a theory which allows us to explain to ourselves how and why things happen in society for 3 purposes. 1, to grasp what the real effect of current legal phenomena is. 2, to say how words can affect those legal phenomena. 3, to decide what the consequences of the effects of words on those legal phenomena are and what they ought to be, such that we, as people making things happen in society using words, have the best possible chance of putting the right words in the right place at the right time in order to achieve something in society that we think ought to occur. Anybody who believes that that's a deterministic process is not going to be a happy lawyer, because it isn't. Anybody who thinks it isn't worth doing isn't going to be a happy lawyer, because lawyers want to make things happen in society using words that they believe are good, even if they fool themselves into thinking that it doesn't matter whether they're good as long as they are well paying. And anybody who actually can gain even a little bit of an edge on the social, political, and psychological insights necessary to be better than the average bear at making things happen in society using words can be a fulfilled, well-paid, and indeed happy lawyer. That doesn't mean that he, she, they, or it can be happy people. To be a fulfilled and remunerated lawyer is not necessarily to be happy in life, but it's a very good start. Because to be able to make things happen in society using words that you believe are good, and to be paid for doing that, what you need in order to have a life that you feel is unconstrained by want of money, is, if not a guarantee of happiness, far more on the side of happiness than most human beings can ever achieve. So we really need, a lawyer's theory of social action. You don't really need a summer job. You think you do, but you don't. You don't really need to get the best grade in corps. Indeed, you don't need to get a good grade in corps. Indeed, if you happen to be me at the beginning of my career as a lawyer, or in fact me at any time during my career as a lawyer, you don't need to take corps. I never did. Or tax. I never did. I have dealt with problems in which corporations law and tax law were required in both my practice and my life, and I have learned the law I needed as I learned it, maybe better, maybe worse, but well enough. But you do need a lawyer's theory of social action. That is, if you want to be even a little bit better than the average bear at making things happen in society using words and to be happy. Maybe you don't. Maybe you just need an income of $500,000 and the Kent Scholarship designation. In which case, I can help you with that too, but it's really a bullshit job helping you to do that. Because after a third of a century of doing it, I know what happens after the end of the play. So what would it mean to have a lawyer's theory of social action? Well, having a theory of social action would apparently mean being a social scientist. The one social science present in law school, economics, has a theory of social action, but it has a very weak understanding of the human beings who live in society, which is part of what it regards as its strength, because then it can use math, which is to contemporary economics what logic is to the legal thought of Felix Cohen's time, or Holmes's, or 600 years before. There's also sociology, and there's anthropology, and there's intrapsychic psychology, the study of the individual mind, and there's social psychology, the influence of minds on minds. In fact, really, what we have to understand is that there are as many theories of social action as there are combinations of social science perspectives that we could bring to bear, different ways of both gathering information and interpreting its meaning. But we're looking for a lawyer's theory of social action. And that's a different thing. It's not one that people want to think about who aren't lawyers. They mostly want to think about lawyers as a foreign substance. And therefore, it's not about winning prizes as purist sociologists or anthropologists or... And it's got to work because we're lawyers and the things are what they do. So our theory of social action is what it does. That is, as previously defined, how does it make it possible for us to be better than random at choosing the words we use in order to make things happen in society? So we need to begin by stating the principle of the lawyer's theory of social action. We swiped it from Darwin. One of the most important aspects of the idea we call Darwin, though not the one we most readily associate with the idea we call Darwin, which is the idea that natural selection has been the dominant force in shaping the history of life. One of the important aspects of the idea we call Darwin is its methodological proposition, the one that really is largely to be associated with Charles Darwin. The theory of evolution has existed in many different forms, in many different places, at many different times in human thought. And the theory of evolution as motored by, powered by, structured by natural selection occurred more or less simultaneously to Wallace as to Darwin. What is really jus de Darwin in the idea we call Darwin is the mode of demonstrating, which is consilience. Consilience, the Latin idea that things jump together, if you please, if you want to understand its idiom, the idea of consilience is that we demonstrate things effectively when we have multiple independent methods of investigation, perhaps using completely different forms of evidence and certainly different methods or structures of interpretation which lead us by commonality to a conclusion. because when reasoning from three or four independent bodies of understanding in independent ways, we reach similar or overwhelmingly the same conclusion, and we therefore believe in the consilience of our explanations what we would believe by the consensus of investigators. A lawyer's theory of social action, then, is consilient in nature, and it depends upon multiple independent forms of social investigation, reasoning, and conclusion. We are interdisciplinary social thinkers because we need, as lawyers, to have ideas that pay out in work, that have what John Dewey famously but deceptively referred to as cash value, that our ideas can be taken to market and shown not merely to be attractive in the market, not merely to be saleable in the market if you dress them up, but actually at the end of the day to bring home the bacon. You can see the way in which America is the locale of this idea. We are, in that sense, American legal realists, not only because of our realism, that is, not only because the law is to us what it does, we are making things happen in society using words, and the test of our words is the happening they bring about. But we are, at the end, believers that in the struggle of the market, whatever we mean by market, which is probably not the market, the value of what we do is tested over time. For me, that's the market in legal services, in which I want you not merely to be a profitable trader, but to be driving a trade in which you can believe. So, at the base of our reasoning, we understand that human beings are animals, social animals, that biology drives a part of what we see around us in society, because what we see around us in society is human society. Law schools, unfortunately, employ too many economists and too few primatologists, in my opinion. It's really important to know how primates behave, how they perform their politics and their economy. But we are, as the readers of Darwin were too, determined to dissociate ourselves from the reality of our animal condition. We are, as Disraeli tells us, between ape and angel, but we love to remember the angel, and we need to forget, as Desmond Morris says, the naked ape. Above the level of our shared animality, the biology that contributes to the nature of our society, including, let us point out, the absolute universality of misogyny in human affairs. Above the level of our animality, we are the thinking creature. We're very proud of that, and so we ought to be, because whatever it is that mind is, it's quite a thing. Whether we can take any more credit for it than our partners, whom we deny the credit to, that's another question. But we have mind, and it weighs on us. Whether we are Prince Gautama, the one who was here and is gone, or we are Freud, the one who was here and is gone, we find it difficult to remind our fellow human beings of what a burden our mind is. But in our intrapsychic psychology, in the psychology of one mind all on its own, on what it's really made of and how it functions, much depends. Hence, in order to have a lawyer's theory of social action, we will need to have a theory of personality. We want the theory of personality in order to understand the persons with whom we deal, our network, our adversaries, the decision makers, public opinion, though that requires us, of course, to go beyond and understand something about the influence of minds on minds, which is the next step in our staircase. We need a theory of personality. I will submit to you a few weeks from now that there is a good theory of personality for a social theory of lawyers. It's not quite the theory of personality you have been previously working with, but it will be recognizable enough to make you not want to recognize it, which is a good test for a theory of personality. We then must indeed consider, from the discipline of social psychology, the influence of minds on minds. This is persuasion, a subject of great importance to lawyers. And public opinion, a subject of great importance to lawyers. And mass hysteria and misinformation, subjects of great importance, and so on and so on. A jury is a society influenced by others, but containing within it an influence of minds on minds, enough said. And indeed, we mustn't overlook the material consequences of the behavior of human beings in their minds and in society. And so, as Holmes says, the person of economics is a person. Not quite as much of a person as the persons of economics in law school like to maintain. We shall meet one day my friend the econodwarf. Reductionism is a danger in this part of the world, as quicksand is a danger in marshes. And we need to think about how it is that the forms of social organization are themselves redolent of meaning and causative of effect. So, like the sociologists, we have questions of morphology and stratification, structural barriers, forms of impacted power joined into institutions which can live themselves independently over centuries. In the United States, we think at present, we are thinking about racism that way, though I have to say I suspect it's a fad that goes away quickly. It's a very hard perspective for those who actually have been always benefiting from the institutional structures to observe, and those who have always been not benefiting, anti-benefiting, indeed crushed under the weight of those structures, get really, really tired of trying to explain. That's a phenomenon of the first law of social psychology for lawyers. You cannot make people see an invisible thing by showing it to them. But we do have to study the rules of social psychology for lawyers, of which, in the first instance, there are six, and you've just heard the first. You know the second. Hominid primates believe what they see and imagine what they hear. And then, of course, we do have to consider not merely the psychological and material elements of the forces of society, but the symbolic ones as well, which we call culture. Lucy Kramer Cohen lived from the era of Franz Boas to that of Clifford Geertz. We can too, though Felix didn't make it. And we need to consider the historical mode of social understanding, the one in which it so happens that my other PhD is made, the one in which we try and understand the role of contingency in human affairs, how to integrate what happens to happen with the social forces that make happening what it is, whatever is means. The historian's role, however familiar it may be to me, however much I may have studied to understand and perform it as apprentices must in my youth, where Cohen's philosophy way, the historical mode of understanding is relatively poorly described by historians and always poorly described by everybody else, unless they begin by recognizing that when it gets dark and the eyesight begins to fail, human beings gather around the fire and tell stories. Once you know that, you can begin consiliently through intrapsychic psychology and social psychology and material investigation to have a social theory of action for historians. But that's a glove box, because the action occurs in the past and the understanding occurs in the present, and the past and the present are two different places. The historian depends upon that. But we need to think about it, because historical analysis is part of how, from the point of view of having a theory of social action in the now, you'd want to work. I often say, with respect to my law practice, that the first thing I did was to get a PhD in history, and then I went out to practice. Because, indeed, so it seems to me. And then we would want the philosophy, which Felix Cohen would rightly say is both the effort of a Protestant kind, says Felix Solomon Cohen, to dispel meaningless ideas. And then, on the other hand, to give words meaning, philosophically speaking, by knowing what they really mean. Understanding that the philosopher P.F. Strawson is correct when he says that when philosophers say something is really real, they almost always mean it isn't real, really. And understanding, well, the things Wittgenstein says, which are complicated because he has said all things and all meanings lead down one mistaken road with wrong signs on it. People have noticed that there is some relationship between Wittgenstein and Cohen. And in a couple of journals, I have been invited to discuss it. But actually, I discussed it already once and wrote an article about it on Wittgenstein's theory of legal indeterminacy and contemporary legal theory with a fellow who was a student in this course once upon a time, and a German Cambridge philosopher, but never mind. You'll find it out if you really want to know. So what we are doing is borrowing from disciplines. Hopefully not borrowing with any intent to return whatever, not to attend symposia and write law review articles and the other forms of false returning, the kind that Americans call Indian giving. Hopefully we are, as T.S. Eliot is aware, ennobled by our refusal to return. Good poets borrow, says T.S. Eliot. Great poets steal. So that's what I hope we're doing. We are plundering. We are stealing from multiple disciplines, taking their insights, adding our irony, compelled, as lawyers ought to be compelled, either to be in very great and loving pursuit of justice or in equally determined and much more ferocious hatred of injustice, off taking our stolen weapons and our purloined armor and using it to see whether we can find multiple reasons, from the line that comes from our biology as human animals, through the line that comes from the multiplicity of our personalities through the line that comes from our understanding of public relations and the influence of minds on minds through the line which gives us a little bit of macroeconomic or microeconomic reasoning through the line which gives us the sociology of the institutions through the line which allows us to interpret the culture and to know the history and etc. So that in these multiple roads we converge on the square of the thing we meant to change, using the words we meant to use to make the thing happen in society that we thought was good. That, in a nutshell, would be the basis of our theory of social action for lawyers. As we develop it, every blue book becomes a canvas on which we paint. Every question asked by a law professor tunneling through the material in the way he thinks is clever becomes an opportunity to be clever. Once upon a time, when I was in law school, there was a lawyer. I mean, he was sort of a lawyer. He was a law professor. But he had just finished having a job in the federal government as the general counsel of an agency. So he was an esteemed lawyer. Not by me, but he was esteemed. And I was taking a course in which, being at the time on the Law Review, the journal, if you please, and busy, self-importantly busy, I sometimes attended this course, but I was there occasionally. And on a day when I happened to be there occasionally, this lawyer happened to be making a distinguished guest appearance at the invitation of my teacher so that he could explain what he had learned by being the general counsel of an agency. As you will gather, this was, of course, in administrative law. Actually, administrative process, but never you mind. So the eminence explained his thinking at some length and came to a conclusion which we needn't bother with. And I, experiencing the novelty of being in the class where something was actually happening, sort of, sought to use some words. And I began whatever the words were that I intended to use with the words, "That is the screwiest idea I have ever heard." And then I explained what it was about the idea that had been expressed by this eminence that was, you know, I mean, I used logic to explain why the idea was screwy, although I didn't actually mean that it was screwy because it was illogical. It was screwy because it was ridiculous. But ridiculous is not the way that law thought explains what's wrong with law thought. So like you, I explained, I hope not in a quibbling fashion. But of course, nobody remembered any of that. My contemporary, the law students with whom I was then a, you know, sub-chieftain of the law journal, thank you very much, and what have you, and, well, the distinguished eminence himself, they remembered that what I had to say was that an idea of a teacher, an eminence, a guest, moreover, was screwy, and boy, did they remember, which is fine with me. Looking back on it now, well, almost 40 years later, it is fine with me. Indeed, it will perish with me because I may be the last human being who remembers it. Perhaps by then my contemporaries will have, you know, either much more to think about and remember, or they'll be senile, or maybe I won't live long enough to be the last person who remembers it, but however few there are of us who remember it, it's still fine with me and will remain so. It was the mot juste at the correct moment. But I had a lawyer's theory of social action. Of course, mine was more historical then than psychologically it is now. But I had one, and it ruled this screwy, and I got to say so. And although I am concealing his name and I am compelled to give my own, it doesn't really matter. It's just that, well, in law school, there is no such thing as a mandatory meeting. I know you think there is. But if you really lived your legal realism, you would be fully aware that if there's nothing they can do to you for not showing up, then it's not a mandatory meeting. We're going to develop, well, not one lawyer's theory of social action, but a bunch, I hope, one for each, based on consilient understandings drawn from multiple disciplines designed to illuminate questions of social action for the limited purpose of making things happen in society using words, which is what law school is for. Having said which, let's just think about what law school is for now. It is indeed a tense time in law school now. I read with interest both the incisive stuff said by students about what it means to be in law school now, and the utter verbiage and pure non-specific puffery, to put it shortly, transcendental nonsense, that I hear from, well, everybody who isn't a student about what it's like to be in law school now. There's always too much reading in law school. There's a reason for that. Learning how to read a lot of stuff and get the marrow out the bones without too much sucking is indeed a very important skill in law school. Law school does benefit you by showing you that you are indeed 800 pages behind in the middle of the term. Sure, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with the game of too much reading, except that people ought to explain to you what to do about the game of too much reading, which next time I will. But there is indeed too much reading, not here. I want reading to be done carefully. So, of course, we have to do a less, what shall I say, overwhelming job of reading. I need you to overwhelm the reading, not the reading to overwhelm you. Yes, there is too much fear of being called on, so I don't. Here, after all, we drive the questions the other way. You're not Socrates, I have to tell you. But I'm not Socrates either, and that's fine. We don't need to be Socrates. All of that is based upon the idea that the ideas exist pervasively throughout the universe because they are the forms of things. And even if you just a slave boy, I can get the idea out of you by careful questioning, which, after all, implies, as I have tried to suggest once or twice, that somebody's a slave boy. It works in Plato because, you know, but it shouldn't work here. You're right. That doesn't mean that asking questions in class isn't a good idea. That doesn't mean that having good questions isn't really, 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 really the center of being a lawyer. It doesn't mean that knowing how to cross-examine isn't the skill you ought to be prepared to give your eye teeth for. And if you want to learn how it's done, you got to watch it done. The problem is that you're not a witness and you're not a slave boy. And the goal is to make a powerful thinker and user of words out of you. Now, you can do that in a classroom where somebody asks all the questions. I'm not sure you can do that in a classroom where somebody does it only by asking all the questions using Zoom. That's a little bit like the Mad Libs in bed thing, that using Zoom part, that, you know. The problem is that right now you need to be able to take initiative, which is really hard when you're sitting in the same room all day long and you can almost touch both walls by stretching out your arms. And everything that used to be how you lived your life is in the bottle and you can't get to it because the cork is the epidemic and it won't come out. You need to be able to take initiative. Even those of you who used to be good at taking initiative are not quite on the beam right now, if you ask me. And you could ask me because you're the ones who ask the questions. But in order to take initiative, you have to understand social process. So it gets to be really important to fix law school by adjusting the process of law school to suit the initiative you're prepared to take. And that, unfortunately, isn't how lawyering is done. We have to make things happen in society using words without already controlling society. If you already were capable of addressing its design directly through the exertion of power, then, as Holmes says, you could be a despot with a whimsical turn of mind and still you'd give reasons for your actions. But that's not what we're doing here. We're not giving reasons for being in power. We're giving reasons for making things happen in society. And the reasons, those are rationalizations. And our actual understanding of what is going on, the depth of what we know, will look like magic or like mind reading if we're doing it right. But that seems hard to do. That not non-Socratean scientist Archimedes thinks he can move the world if he has merely a lever long enough and a place to stand. But your lever's not long enough and you don't have anywhere to stand except your place where you're imprisoned until the epidemic is over. Well, at least if you are like me, this is 326 days in my apartment. So, under those circumstances, the idea that what you're supposed to do is to take initiative in learning will be hard to achieve when all you're supposed to do is keep the camera turned on, look reverently attentive, stare into the screen, and answer the questions. You'd pretty much have to be prepared to dramatize how screwy you think the ideas are. And in order to do that, indeed, you'd have to feel confident enough to think you'd done the reading and that it was your questions that mattered. So I agree that law school should be like that. Indeed, my law school is like that. Indeed, I spent 7.5 years knowing that one day we would all be here where we are now, trying to figure out under those circumstances how to teach law school. And of course, one of the things that means is you have to have a journal. That is to say, there has to be a private, maintained, memory-riven place where you can write about that to me only, and I can write back to you only, and so we can structure the experience so it has that quality for you. And indeed, of course, we ought all to agree that grades are stupid. And because we are people who think that things are what they do, we should waste no time on the stupid things. So pretty much I find myself entirely with the program. Indeed, I foresee that this will be the necessary program, and I am trying to provide this program, and therefore, because I have a lawyer's theory of social action, I know exactly what you're going to do if I provide the program that you want, namely, you're going to reject it and fight about it with me, which you do. Which is not unfine. I don't have a sense of rejection, longing, and loss about it, because I know you have to do what you are doing, even if you don't know why, because the majority of human mental activity is unconscious. In an academic institution like a law school, one of our peer schools, in an academic institution such as this, the thing we call counseling is advising. We used to really have psychological assistance available for law students too, but it's been almost 20 years since that was really functioning even the half well that it functioned when I arrived here in 1987. And as for advising, well, it used to be that people had a faculty advisor, and the faculty advisor was funded to take the students to lunch twice a term. But beyond that, of course, faculty had to believe that advising was an important part of the job, and even without the epidemic, that's hard. Contemporary law teachers believe that weekly bloviation ceremonies are important, and the patronage system called appointments, namely the hiring of faculty, is important. And it's all very time-consuming, and law review articles are important to write, and advising students, even when we aren't all locked up in our separate isolation booths, is really, really hard to do quickly, even by the standards of law school quickly, let alone by the standards of therapy quickly. So you have to be capable of pulling off the illusory trick that Freud himself pulls off in the process of inventing the idea called Freud, which is to be capable of analyzing yourself. And that's actually a lie, like autobiography is a lie. But you have to know, with the firm conviction of consilient reasoning, that you exist as an agent, as a subject, as the creator, driver, impresario, and orchestra of your own education. I don't make violins. I don't teach violin playing, not in this course. What I teach in this course is how to know that you're already a violinist. Now you go and do the rest. Talk to you soon.